Yes, sir.
Yeah, talking about these ambiguities and everything that's happening, I've lived with these all my life. I must admit that his humanity comes through. And his humanity comes through, for me, for good or ill, it wasn't about India. It was about the First World War when he said, I think I'm quoting correctly, a young man fighting in France said, when they ask us how we died, tell them that our fathers lied. And that actually opened the door a bit, because when I was young, I think when you're young, you're a bit arrogant and you might snap judgment about people. And of course, when you go through Kipling, this humanity does shine through. Another one, we bashed them with martinis. Not the drink, but the vitamin. We bashed them with martinis, but it wasn't our affair. So I think we can. I think we would all agree that when we read Kipling, there's this humanity there. But I still, maybe I'm simplistic, but I'm still even now trying to balance it. This imperialism, this white man burden, and all this. How does he stack up here? Or is he meant to stack up? Are we meant to find an answer in the harm that he might have done?
I don't think.
Could I just comment on that?
Yeah.
Something that came through that you were talking about anger in India. What you said and what came out of the kid. Rather borne out by Prince Stewardship. There were tarmac roads and train trains on. But I speculated on what India's future. What shape in the future might take that we should not be separated by this enormous class consciousness, this enormous consciousness, which we're deformed in every way of life. It came out about the deserving and the undeserving poor. I mean, if you've got that in our country, it would be quite a conservative. But it's perpetuated. Interesting question. Caught up in all of this. But it raised that. There are signs of Kipling which show his humanity. Perhaps this is also effectively following back in the glory of the God. Relates more commonly to that.
Can I suggest this, that what is different about literature as opposed to political left? And I don't want to be go out and present its answers to the question, but I think it needs to answer the question. The essence of great literature is always ambiguity. Nobody actually wants to read something by an author who is so transparent that they're reflected in every character whose life you know without having to read their biography and discover different things about them, whose opinions are, you know, become opinionated. Throughout the text. That is perfectly acceptable in political writing, because within political writing we're dealing with usually with quite naked interests, and it is quite right that those interests should be represented by a text which doesn't disguise them or disguise the writer's relationship to them. But it is actually the ambiguity of relationship which always makes writing great. And it's actually a lack of that. I go the other way, and I'll say why somebody like the Webbs writing about India would not be fitting for any more than the Webbs writing about Russia. It's because they lack any sort of ambiguity. I mean, they're writing about Russia. When the Webbs write about Moscow, it might as well be Hampstead, because the Webbs take Hampstead all around the world and judge the world according to that, rather like the Sunday Times colour supplement does today. Kipling is an interesting writer precisely because of the fact that on the one hand he recognises his dislocated section of the working class, you know, the Tommy character, who's thrown out, that he finds himself in, when he's needed in time of war, he's important. When he's not needed, when the war's over, he's insignificant. And Kipling can perceive that ambiguity, and very often he doesn't realise why he perceives that ambiguity. I think you can transfer this to so many other artistic forms. I think Bob Dylan was probably one of the greatest writers of lyrics about the sort of the angst of living under capitalism in the 20th century. But I don't think he had a bloody clue what he was saying. I don't think he understood anything about capitalism. And then some of us used to hold a discussion, we'd say, yeah, sit there listening to Desolation Row and say, oh, well, this is, of course, a study of the stock exchange. Well, Bob Dylan didn't know that. He was buying Vietnam War bonds at the time, wasn't he? And again, I think I'd rather watch a play by Harold Pinter any day of the week than Brecht. I thought most of the plays such as they are, Brecht, they didn't interest, because there's no ambiguity. There's nothing sort of at all uncertain or unresolved about any of it. It's all resolved. Whereas, with Harold Pinter, it's all unresolved, but on the other hand, you think to yourself, bloody hell, the tensions of life are all here, they're all exposed. And I think that's why Kipling, has been rightly sort of rehabilitated here today. I think it's a justifiable thing to have done, that we should be talking about those writers who aren't saying things to please us. I mean, if literature is only to please people, then, of course, capitalism would be the ideal setting for any literature to be written, because it's under capitalism that you pay someone to write things. That's why they bloody teach Shakespeare characters so much in school, because he was a quintessential court lackey who wrote what the emerging British ruling class wanted to hear, and they were so delighted, right? They've been repeating his old nonsense ever since. I think it's old nonsense. Although the only correction I ever had to write in the Socialist Stand over 20 years was when I did write with Shakespeare, it was old nonsense, and the party forced a repudiation of it. So I don't know whether the same thing's going to happen to you over Kipling. I don't know whether you're bowed to the will of democracy and say it was an imperialist swine. But it was an imperialist swine. But imperialist swines can say interesting things. Sometimes more interesting things than Ben Elton.
I think the point that people sometimes miss is that if you're going to, when Kipling wrote what was right propaganda, it's much better than bad propaganda. It's much more subtle and much more effective. And I think that is, and the same with colonial domination. It is actually much more subtle to do it in the way that the British did than to go in, which perhaps in the way the Americans attempted to, in some of it, isn't rather more. And there was a subtle relationship between the colonial colonised and the colonial power, which is about a game of domination.
Mm. One of the things that occurs to me in this context is the long-term dilemma of socialists looking at the role of empire. And we saw in Russia, where the ruling class emerged after the Russian Revolution of 1917, carried over a lot of baggage from their association with the idea of Marxism. And this led to an extensive dilemma, which at different times expressed itself in different directions, on their attitude towards Tsarist Russia's eastward move and its conquest of Central Asia and the Caucasus, and their attitude towards it. Now, they had to, as radical critics of society, as they started out as, to see merit and value in the social developments and economic developments that followed with the impact of Western technology and ideology and scientific thought and so on. on the one hand, and at other times they showed a sensitivity towards the loss of cultural traditions and the loss of craftsmanship and other aspects. Now, that was brought out more sharply in the Russian context for no greater reason, I would suggest, than the fact that they had this Marxist baggage, which rather forced them to look at this question a little more. But in the British context, an assessment of the role of empire is not irrelevant, in the sense that, just as the Russians found a dilemma, there is a dilemma for us too in looking at the role of British imperialism and the fact that it wasn't a wholly negative process, that built in with the development of their empire was the development of economic and social procedures which led to advance, I suppose. I leave you with that thought. Is that your hand, Sandy, to say something? Yeah. There's a door between you and the rest of us, so speak up so we can hear.
I was just going to ask, you made what I usually understand. But what would you say? I only know Kevin because I've heard it as a play on Radio 4 years ago. But I believe when I first heard it, it was still the Home Service. I'm not sure you heard more than what it was. Both in Kim and Kipling's other writings, mixed race, if you use that term, community has been dealt with in various ways. What would you have to say about Kipling's attitudes there? Because I think this is where he comes out most clearly as being confused with racism of some sort or other.
Actually, I don't know much about his attitudes towards mixed race children, boys, who are given this very privileged education, but they're also seen as not quite acceptable in the community. And Kim is somehow, from time to time, Kim comes across as being presented as somewhat superior because he is completely a white boy, not half caste, as children in my school call us, those of us who are mixed race. But I don't know if perhaps you know more about it.
I
only
know what Margaret
Elasky
told me.
What was that?
Our programmes, which she did on Kipling, taught them in the life. And basically, Kipling did have, seems to have had attitudes towards some of these characters. There's a character called Michelle Nacuz, for example. I don't know if I'm remembering the story, but he shows timorous at a certain point in doing something or other. And Kipling dwells on the fact that this is the black in him coming out. It's not as crude as I've made it sound, but that's basically what he says, is that he uses that term, black, to note the racial content as well, which is making him not square up and sort of be equal to the situation. So it seems to have had some, although he was clearly interested in and fascinated by him, and in some sense empathetic to him, and in a great sense empathetic to culture, very profound in India. There was also this other attitude which, maybe he was as much a schizophrenic as other people. That's just me.
Did you?
No.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very good topic about the Kitty. I have to confess I haven't read that one anyway. I would like to ask again about cultural imperialism. The missionaries, from West, especially from Britain, when they did Africa, they converted many religion, cultures, people. But they have been for at least 300, 200 years in India. Did they import any Western culture? What do you mean by cultural imperialism? did they do anything apart from exploitation things like that? But what kind of, what is cultural imperialism?
What is cultural imperialism?
Yeah, so, well, I've heard of that. I mean, even Edward Said used to say before. And
if you go to if you go to that part of the world, there's missions.
Yeah, what I'm trying to say is yes, but the Indians still adhere to their own culture, you know, despite, you know, the foreign domination by the West. But if you go to take example, the Western, they don't have any language, their own specific language, because it's in English now. And in Africa also, mainly change the names, you know, especially for the Southern Africa, from the native names, change it to Europeans, because most of the missionaries, they told them, if you have this name, you're going to be go to heaven or things. They convert them religious-wise and any kind of culture, the way to dress, the way, everything. But what I'm saying is, although the exploitation, everything remained the same, the Indian culture is so strong. When you mention the Lama, he's not a missionary like Livingstone, you know, in Africa, but he was a strong character or spiritual leader. That is a little bit different from other missionaries.
Yes. I suppose in some ways, perhaps say that the impact on India doesn't seem to have been quite as brutal as it was in Africa. Mm. But nevertheless, there was a lot of destruction of the native culture, and there are whole generations of people for whom their first language is really English, not the Indian or Sri Lankan mother tongues. And my father was totally educated in English and reads and writes English because that was the dominant language of education. And that is, although he grew up speaking his mother tongue, it was not something that was taught in school. And in the same way that people in India and in Sri Lanka and that part of the world have a lot of knowledge about Western culture because it was taught European history, British history, English literature, all those things are taught. But it had a very strong impact. And there are whole communities of Indian people and Sri Lankan people who are very anglicised and it's very much seen even by people in those communities that somehow it's superior to be Western. Which is quite a frightening thought that it has so pervaded the minds of the people themselves that they're prepared to give up their cultural heritage and background. But I mean, perhaps in other ways, to look at it very glibly, it could be not quite brutal.
I think when you mentioned the language, I think as I understand it, they said because there are 400 languages in India. The most common denominator, I think they may compromise, that's what, not necessarily force them to speak English, but so many languages in India that English was spoken, that's what they did. That's.
Your former observation about it being much more subtle in India is not true. I'm thinking that it's easier to spot in the case of the conquistador in South America, where the military conquest combined with the so-called Christian mission.
Just a suggestion. It's in different historical circumstances in which Africa and India came under the weather and given into the West on the steel, as it were. I mean, as far as I'm aware, Africa first featured as a source of slaves to the West. And then they start to go into Africa when industrial capitalism is well underway and, it's part of commercial expansion and fairly sort of well-developed commercial expansion by that time, whereas in India it was probably more bit by bit and a mixture of sort of trade and attempts to win territory and sort of strike deals with princes and this sort of thing. And the main world would be more of a direct connection between South Asia and the rest of Asia and Europe. The connections may go back a bit further. So the actual attitudes that the Westerners took may have been somewhat different, still perhaps superior and what have you, but not quite as the same way.
Seems to be a good male whale guy.
In his lifetime, did you receive any notices from contemporary Anglo-Indians for showing an interest in the community? I mean, if you read Orwell's book, that's one of the themes, that people who are showing an interest in the Indian community, except as concubines, are most frowned upon and shunned.
Well, he left India when he was 23, but he found it difficult when he was in India, that his newspapers neutral and then grudging support for this bill that was going to give Indian magistrates the power to try everyone, including white people. When they were showing support for this, Kipling found it very difficult because the Anglo-Indian community was incensed by this. They fought a vicious propaganda campaign against it, and to even maintain a position of neutrality made you seem like a traitor, and Kipling found that very difficult. And he felt he also tried to absolve himself from it because it was his paper rather than him. He did obviously find it difficult, and I think that he found it very difficult to break away from that community and its views. But at the same time, he addressed them because the paper that he worked for was very much the paper of this Anglo-Indian community in the town. And some of the short stories, like Plain Tales from the Hills, that were published first in that paper. And also some of his poems, were published in that paper. I think he felt also that he wrote them in the particular style that they're written in, for this particularly kind of uncultured group of English. It was something that would appeal to them, but at the same time they also contain criticisms of perhaps in one or two cases individuals in that community, and sometimes criticisms of their way of life or an insight into their way of life. Again, this ambivalence.
But isn't it in his defence when you're talking about he's showing black people? Everyone at the age, a dominant thought, with different characteristics, racial characteristics, dominated different groups, and the idea of the Russian people always needed to have a czar to dominate. It wasn't an insulting thought, it was the thought that everyone thought was a proper way of describing. It's not nowadays, that's patronizing and insulting. Because everyone thought the same racial characteristics were still in the group.
I don't know if everyone thought that, but certainly, yes, you have to put Kipling in context. I do think it's a bit of a waste of time to try and condemn Kipling for something when he just happens to be a person who's living in his time and has put certain views of his time. But having said that, not everyone thought those things. And if Kipling really wanted to make any claims, which he's dead, so it wasn't likely to be a socialist or something, then perhaps he would have had to change a lot of that, the way he thought of it.
Yeah.
I'm getting the sense that you've done the trick of baking. The general reaction to the visit.
Well, Bateman's is people who perhaps haven't been there is a place where Kipling lived when he came back from India, and it's very much a Well, it's a very the home of a wealthy English person. What I found interesting is the interior, because there was this very artistic blend of East and West, really, and also in the style of the arts and crafts movement, because everything was very tasteful and very, very much in accordance with a lot of what William Morris would have to say about furniture and so on. But including the Eastern aspect as well, and then obviously there was a lot of his father's work
in the place as well, and he's an accomplished artist. Yes, Dickens is interesting from that point of view.
I can make a confession about this today. I just want to hear the reaction. This is exactly, it's understated.
Yeah,
that is the offence of Kipling. Well, you know, maybe perhaps at that particular time, we've got to go back, I suppose, it's not kind of 20th century literature, really, the back end of the 19th century, isn't it? And of course, the bourgeoisie of any imperialist country, it would occur to me, if we go into the realms of music and opera and show, the bourgeoisie itself had some spleen. It had something to offer by definition. That's where they were. So I think that to that extent, we don't have to attack or defend the bourgeoisie at that time. Was a bourgeoisie perhaps past its apex, but nevertheless not so far past its apex as the current bourgeoisie. And just, you know, as thoughts flashed through my mind, I was thinking at least we can talk about this cultural imperialism. Do we have to wait and think about, well, I'm thinking, what is a murder? Is it better than hamburger imperialism? Because I was going to say you can get your teeth into it. Sorry about that. But you see, the bourgeoisie at that period, it wasn't, they did have something to offer. And I think if you look at music, you know, the melodies of Puccini and things like this, thank Christ, what the bourgeoisie had to offer the world no longer offers the world, and that's why it's even more essential to move it on, because it's past this bloody peak. That's it, that's what we're going to do.
I've been recently introduced to the writings of Arthur Hayden Young, and found them very adoring, very interesting. The one I read first is The Youngster Trying to Get Through the VA of the Recalls. I found it bizarre to read of his in-depth discussions with his fellow students on the characters in Shakespeare's plays, in Shakespeare's writing, and the meanings, and I thought that this cultural imperialism, sort of, this is how it's handled, its education system sort of imposes cultural imperialism in a gentler way. His one desire after getting to the degree is probably to come to England and get a job here somewhere. And he was pushed in this aim by his parents, who thought this would be a continuous achievement, should he do this. And I think that the education system is part of the bourgeoisie, and I don't think that it necessarily is such an epitome of achievement either. It's just the state of society at that time. Productive capacities now include world music in their output. They're not relying on the cultural of the Western world, achievement, for example. Nevertheless, it's a market economy. It is still producing to make money, to make capital, to make profits. And I think this is in the forefront of any society and culture and country while we have capitalism. That's the complete apex of any culture. Anybody trying to work towards a culture, it's going to be the culture of the domineering economic forces of that time.
But isn't this exactly one of the great political problems that are in front of us now? Because the big new fad, if you like, is the politics of identity, isn't it? Now, class is a thing of the day. You mustn't talk about class. It dates you, doesn't it? No. Rather, don't mention class in academic circles, certainly. You know, you don't mention class in politics. It's a Labour Party, Labour. You never mention class now. Rather difficult, some of you ask them why they're called the Labour Party. But on the other hand, now you've got the politics of identity, the politics of spurious communities, a gay community. You know. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that someone
is a homosexual who's, you know, working on the railways, is in the same position as Prince Edward. Oh! State secrets slip out there, sorry. Allegedly. But, I mean, you know, the community of women. Well, you know, what's a, you know, women entirely as a community? Or a community of, you know, I mean, people talk about a black community. And there's a guy at a place where I work, he's teaching a course on this thing called a Pache Indian. You know, he thinks he's an anthropologist. He thinks he's discovered something brilliant. You know, he said, oh, this is a thing, this is a fusing of identities. I said, well, it's a load of commercialized bollocks, basically. Anybody will recognize that this is a, you know, this is just throwing together things in order to create ideals of community, images of community, feelings of belonging in a world which is fundamentally alienated, and all that is inevitably going to be alienated as long as you've got a class of people who own it and a class of people who are the lodgers, which is what the working class are. I don't mean you have to talk about the working class, just talk about the lodgers. You've got the landlords and the lodgers. We live here on their terms. You know, at the end they say, well, incidentally, and they don't pay us wages, we pay them wages. That's another myth. Never let anybody tell you that that your boss pays you a wage. You pay your boss a wage and keep for yourself a small amount of what you produce. That is how it works, except because he's got legal control over it, or she's got legal control over it. Incidentally, if it's a woman who happens to be robbing you. But this thing about identity, I think, the big thing, I think what our friend over there was saying is a good point on one level, that people in the 19th century used to have very simplistic racial stereotypes. But a lot of this is now actually coming from people who are allegedly progressive. Mm-hmm. You know, the post-Marxist, post-modernist, post-Marxist. Post is the big thing today. If any of you want to get into university, let me just go in there, you know. And they say, you know, I came here on, you know, the post-underground, and, you know, came out through the post-door, you know, post-lamp-box.
Post-haste.
Yeah, post-haste, you know. And you'll get in, because that is the way. I tell you now, you just thought about, you know, I mean, I lecture in a university. If you wake up one morning, you've got a headache, you know, you can't think what to say. What am I doing? Oh, post bollocks. You just go in there and just say, oh, post, before anything you'll say. And it kills them out. You know, people, they're quite satisfied. That's the problem. That's only if you're talking to intellectuals in today, because they can't understand anything. If you're talking to the students, you've got to be a bit more on your guard, because they might see through this. But no, and the point I'm making is that this issue about identity, I think, is a tremendous diversion. And I know the speaker, would agree with it. I'm not for a moment undermining the significance of the fact that we all have a multiplicity of elements to our identities, and that if a person is black in a predominantly white race of society, or is a woman in a predominantly patriarchal society, of course this is something that should be ignored or simply, you know, covered up by talking about political correctness or whatever. Of course not. But the danger of this politics of identity is you are allowed to identify yourself as anything but your class position. But it is actually only from your class position that you can win the battle, because the alternative to it is you have battles. So that in Chicago, Illinois, where they have just elected the first black woman senator, to great delight a year ago when she was elected for the first time, they are now suffering from the fact that she is introducing a bill in the Senate to bring about the death sentence for young children, for people under the age of 13, involved in handgun offences. So, in other words, here you have a classical case where the ghetto, which is essentially a product of class, slums, poverty, lack of money, lack of power, is something which is all of the ethics of capitalism, which is that you kill off the section of the working class who you can't cope with, you lock them up, you attack them. This is a class response. She's adopting that class response of the ruler, and to a great extent getting away with it, because she's appealing to identity.
which is seen as being progressive. We've got to, I think, all resist it. Enormously. Yeah. And I think it's one of the big things in the 1990s that socialists are up against. Because it's very untrendy and very unhip to talk about the fact that what you are advocating are the politics of the working class. But the politics of the working class, remember one thing, that puts us in an overwhelming majority. You cannot defeat a majority of workers who understand and want a different kind of society. But you can always defeat various sections of the working class by turning them against each other and within each other, by rewarding some at the expense of others. And actually, that is the whole history of imperialism, but it's also the whole history of capitalism, the whole history of how reforms have been dished out in capitalism, how government has been perpetrated in capitalism. And I would say, you know, one of the lessons of this discussion about imperialist culture is we have to resist the danger of letting other people define who we are. In saying that, I'd add one rider, and that is, I don't have any love for the working class. In fact, I have no pleasure in working class at all. My attitude is, the working class can kiss my ass. But, having said that, I would say, therefore we want the abolition of the working class. Not, I'm not suggesting we turn the working class into another one of these identities, where we say, being working class is a great thing. But being working class is a bloody horrible, dirty thing. You want to get out of the working class, not celebrate it. But you've got to recognise you're in it before you can get out of it. That's the nature of any prison situation.
I'm glad you said that at the end, actually, because what I was going to say is really the most important form of cultural imperialism is the imposition of the status of working class on the majority of people of the world.
Yeah.
And in fact, in India, there are people who didn't understand what it was to be a member of the working class simply because they lived outside of a capitalist society until recently, tribal people. And they actually resent this is the ultimate cultural imperialism, being forced into becoming workers. And I mean, workers at the very bottom of the pile in the seasonal construction workers on the large industrial project and so on. And in fact, this has caused some tension between them and in fact the more traditional communist Indian groups, because they don't want to be members of the working class. It's not a matter of pride. Be that what they want is a way of life that excludes capitalism and all its labels that it imposes on people. But it's very important, though, to understand, I think sometimes in also that what can happen is that people's identities, which are important to them, their cultural identities, their gender identity and so on, which are very complex and multifaceted, can get missed. And so this label of working class, even in the hands of supposed socialists, can be something that is a domineering kind of thing to impose on people, which denies people the very different stories that they have to tell of their experience under capitalism, which is part of the working class experience, and we should always recognise that. And that is why, for me, it's very important. I do understand a bit about cultural imperialism, because when I came to Britain, to university, I was stunned at the Eurocentricness of my course. And I couldn't understand. I mean, it was not even that people were saying to me, well, the culture of other parts of the world is inferior. It was so inferior, it wouldn't even figure. You know, it was just not. And when you wanted to talk about these things, you felt like a real oddity somehow, because you were bringing up things that people didn't want to know about even. And that is when it's at its most dangerous, is when they're ignoring what exists. And for me, it's been very important to read writers like Kipling as well, to understand where those people are coming from as well, the other side. You've got to understand all the different perspectives and what is the experience of the, you know, the young member of the BMP who's been denied any kind of identity by capitalism except to be a frustrated member of the working class full of hatred for everyone else. It's very important to understand where people like that are coming from if we are going to bring about a change. And to do that, we have to go into things a lot deeper than to just say we are all members of the working class. We are all
individuals with very different experiences of being working class, with very different stories to tell, different things that we've lost and different things that we've gained as well, in trying to overcome that. And it's very important to understand that individualism. And I think that is one of the appeals for Kipling, because despite his political views, he did understand the importance of individuals as well, I think.
That's true.
Zadanov
didn't like Kipling.
Yes.
Yeah, let's back to, again to culture, I mean the culture. I think individualism, I respect even the Socialist Party will adopt prioritizing individualism will be respected. But I think culture is not static. I mean, if a child from China lives in London, was born in London, he would be the same, adapted to the London way of life. And if a child from London also lives in Calcutta, he will adopt the same. I think there is no cultural identity, things like that, similar to national liberation. I remember in the 1970s, many people, Mozambique or other countries, Angola, they were, slogan many times, about independence from the Portuguese colonialism, and so after the colonial Portuguese gone, look what Angola is going on. And if you take also the Mau Mau in Kenya, they were, national, the liberators of that country, but they became oppressors now. I think the class, if I had money now, I could enjoy a lot of, a Savoy Hotel, have a cup of tea, for £20 or £15 with the rich people. I think the most priority is class. I know that they will, make a joke or accent, a lot of things they make, the establishment. But what we mustn't forget is the class issue. Of course, you have to have your own identity, class things, respect, whatever you are. But the problem is, we try to concentrate it only on that culture things, or my particular independent things like that, or my own group things. I think it's a bit of a waste of time. The main issue is class. That's why the Socialist Party, as the speaker behind, the man behind said, we have to abolish also the working class. I agree with that 100%. We don't want to add, the working class have priority. It's going to be the second ruling class of the next future. I don't want to do that one. So class is, we have to abolish the class system. Okay? But culture, you can change culture, whatever you do.
Yes.
Did I see you trying to
I was thinking about the various things that have been said about working class, because I'm fairly in India, not quite certain where everybody came from. To me, the accords with the class lies in what it does. It's because it given capitalism, working class is the group that produces. And that is what humanity needs. Well, basically, that was all that I wanted to say. But sometimes it's so easy to use a phrase and you lose sight of what that phrase really represents, except when you get to talking here and you really have to think about, I'm a woman there, so gender, this question of your identity is important to me in that sense. But the importance of the path, is what it does. And because it had historically evolved, and because it contains within it the capacity to solve humanity's problems. Because no matter how comfortable in some ways pre-colonial systems were, within those colonial systems there was nearly always the exploiter and the exploited. And to me the importance of the casting is the question that it opens up that you can actually do away with that. That what capitalism and the creation of the working class has created is the ability to solve that problem. And therefore that is why the class, you can't question that class is the important issue, but because of what it does, not because of the it's almost like the accretion of things which stick and you see, crustaceans, you know. It gets hidden, lost. What the word requires, when people use the phrase, it gets lost what it means. And it is about this, we have the capacity to produce, and therefore we can solve.
I see Sandy in the corner. You may not be aware, Sandy, but there's a door between us. I didn't see you before. No, right.
But really, I just wanted to make 2 points. The thing, one with the idea of class kind of domineering one, is partly due to the fact that it's a narrow way it's conceived. Whilst the previous speaker there was right in what she said about the important thing being that the working class produces, it's the kind of point of production mentality which has dominated, say, the Communist Party and certainly the SWP, that is part of the problem. You know, workers are strongest at work. Well, unfortunately, workers don't necessarily spend, in this part of the world anyway, don't necessarily spend the majority of the hours of the day at work and other aspects of their life. And being in the working class isn't defined by the mere fact that you're employed. And half the problem is that there are a lot of workers who've never worked. Seventy percent of the group which I belong, my little identity group, are permanently unemployed. At any one time, the blind population, 70 to 75% of it are not working. And this is something which is a pretty live issue even to those of us who are fortunate enough to have boring, tedious jobs that we'd love to tell our employers to stick up their arses. We can't, because if we did, we'd be sort of on the dole for years and for the rest of our natural. But the other point I wanted to make is this thing of culture. Michael perhaps hit on a point that's been uppermost in my mind when I've thought about this question of identity, although he may have gone too far in the other direction, but the idea of culture as a sort of box within which you're contained is part of the problem here. If we spoke of a cultural background, it might actually make a difference to the way that the thing was conceived. In other words, whilst there are definitely sharp differences between the cultural backgrounds of certain groups of people, if you took, for example, a pygmy in the African jungle, in the rainforest, there's obviously a sharp difference between the cultural experience of somebody like that and somebody living in London. But nevertheless, the point of the culture isn't it that there's a sort of fence around it. It's a more subtle thing. Cultural background mesh in with one another to some extent. In a certain sense, for example, we are all members of or influenced by something called Western European culture, insofar as such a thing exists. On the other hand, between the people here that are, for example, I come from the Lowlands of Scotland, I'm fairly conscious that there are differences in my experience from the people who've been born and brought up down here, for example. But that doesn't make me think that I'm some sort of, they are very strange people whom I don't understand, because there's sufficient in common between us to make communication possible if it was ever a problem in the first place. And similarly, if you go even broader than that, if you go further back in history, there are links between cultures which have then become different, between, for example, the Celts, the Slavs, the Italians, the Hellenes, and the peoples of some of the peoples of India. There are all these links, and we should think that in that sort of sense, that the issue of culture you could put it this way: there are certain people on the left, or what would have been called the left at one time, and you could describe as cultural boxers, both in the sense that they put people in cultural boxes, or they have a tendency to make it sound like that, and also that they, you know, they can get on their cultural high horses and become thought of in the other sense, so to speak. But we want to avoid that at all costs. We want to see this thing of culture as a sort of positive but complex thing.
It's on this question of class that hasn't been defined yet. I mean, the word middle class has been used and the word working class has been used. And one speaker sitting next to me here sort of said, I don't care about the working class, they can kiss my ass. But he also said he was a university lecturer. Now, since we haven't defined middle class and working class, people might get the impression that a working class can kiss my ass, I've got a lecturer job at last. I don't think he meant that in that sense, and simply when he said that, oh, yes, he did. I don't think he meant either when the working class, because, you know, people should get out of the working class. It could be interpreted as meaning that people should stop being factory workers and manual workers and become bank clerks and university lecturers. So, I mean, we've been a bit, amiss or remiss, is it, in not defining what we mean by class. I think it will be made clear that as far as we're concerned, there isn't such a thing as a middle class. It's a myth that the working class is anybody who doesn't own sufficient property to be able to live off the process. It doesn't matter whether you're a university lecturer or whatever. You are a member of the working class. And when we say we want to get rid of the working class, we want the working class ourselves to abolish ourselves by abolishing all classes.
I don't own a bloody university.
I think you wanted to respond to this one. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yes, yeah.
I just go along with what our host has said. And I think it's linked to a problem. And this was demonstrated to me very effectively this week, because I live in a small block of flats in South East London. And I suppose seven or a group of human beings relate to each other. One who was convinced conservative, who cannot relate at all, and get occasion to write me a letter. I'm one in this block, and it was in what's called a projected tendency agreement. I read my letter to that. And so, in the course of this letter he wrote, he has carefully underlined and written, I am an owner, and he's underlined, owner occupied. I really quite appreciated the point of this linking problems to it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, I know. Right. At what point is the desperately awaited tea you used before?
A few points, and maybe try to answer some of the things that came up. Firstly, that I think what we have to understand is that the capitalism, imperialism is capitalism, and I don't think we should separate those two things. But what we have to, how we understand that is by looking at, maybe the back mentioned societies that were pre-colonial societies. And I agree that there was a vast variety of different kinds of societies. Some of them were property-owning, hierarchical societies, some of them weren't. But the difference between those different societies and capitalism is that capitalism is a form of society that extended its power, the ruling class extended its power globally around the whole world. And the ruling class tended to be predominantly Western, though obviously other people also to the capitalist class, and I'm not denying that, but the ethos or the ideology or whatever it is tends to come from the Western perspective, and that gives it its imperialist flavour. The thing about capitalism now is that colonialism has not finished, it's changed its forms, and in fact what we're seeing is a growing extension of that power around the world, and what that is going to do is it's going to destroy any last vestiges of variety and diversity that exist in the world, that existed before capitalist times. And the only way we can re-establish that, the strength of individuals who can express all their multifaceted personalities, the strength of different
cultures and their multifaceted personalities, the only way that can be re-established is by getting rid of that system. And that is a very important thing. Now, the other thing I'd like to focus on, which I maybe got a little bit lost from, is that this series is called A Novel Approach to History. And one of the most empowering things in understanding that gets us away, actually, from sometimes these rather self-defeating arguments as to whether or not someone was a racist bigot or not. The way to get away from that is to understand things in historical context. And one of the most empowering things is to understand your history, to know what has gone before you, why we are in the position that we're in, who resisted things before us, all those things. It's important to understand. And it gives us, because the way in which we get rid of this system is to understand it. You have to know what you're up against, and you have to know that in greater and greater detail. And that is why it is very important to read people like Kipling and all these other people, and to keep an open mind and understand them in the context of history. And that was all I had to say.